Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
From the Palmetto Swamps, to the Piney Woods, to the Oak Flats, you're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. Come on.
You're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast, presented by Scree Gear, performance apparel, hunting apparel. Been talking about them all year. Extremely thankful for their support of the podcast this season. And as we wind down, spring is right around the corner. You've probably heard me say it before. I'm going to say it again. The Scree Summit camouflage pattern is as good, if not the best, springtime turkey hunting camouflage pattern that you'll find. And if you're an avid turkey hunter, you'll know that camouflage is more vitally important there than in probably about anything, maybe other than duck hunting. It's very important, and the Summit pattern is just phenomenal for the spring turkey woods. So check them out, follow them online, go out to YouTube and the social media channels for Scree. That's Skre. You can find out all about their gear. Always got a lot of amazing deals and sales going on, and you can use the code LABH for 20% off of any regular priced items on your first purchase at ScreeGear.com. So shop online, lifetime warranty, sizing guarantee, ScreeGear.com. So we've made it through this long stretch, and I'm calling it a long stretch, and it doesn't really seem like it's that long. It feels like it was only just weeks ago or maybe a month ago that we were talking about early season topics and looking forward to different phases of the season, and now the season is all but over. And it's that time of the year, Kyler, where we tell stories and we reminisce and we think about what we wish we would have done and cherish the things that we did. So just quickly, without delving far off into it, like in a really short, like one or two thought answer, how do you feel about your 21-22 deer season?
I failed. I never bought a crossbow to draw it back while the deer was in range like I planned on.
That was
because it is, I mean, it was a failure. Like, it can only be chalked up to that.
Okay, so let me ask, did you, I haven't thought twice about you.
You forgot.
I did too. I did completely. now, as soon as you said it, I completely remember us having early in the year. We had an episode where we talked about different goals and different things we wanted to do this season, things to accomplish, and you had this wild idea that you were going to get a crossbow, but you weren't going to cock it and load it and cock it until the deer was there in the same way that you would have to draw a bow, and I forgot about that. So did you forget about it, or did you think about it and just never do it, or...
I thought about it and I never did it. Actually, what ended up happening was I unsuspectingly got back into traditional hunting. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of I had this plan to kill something with my trad bow this year, but I didn't fix that plan in place until November. And that was after I told you I was going to do the crossbow thing. And then, it's not that it was stupid. I just, it was more of the fact that it's like, if I buy a crossbow, I'm only like helping there be more crossbows. I'm only like supporting the crossbow side of archery and archery season. So, I think I envisioned like borrowing one rather than like buying one for my, my little silly goal. But anyway, I ended up, substituting the traditional bow instead of the compound. And I never shot anything with the trad bow this year. I played tag with the buck. I think it was the week after you and Colin came and hunt with me. But I didn't hurt it. I just literally bounced it off its back. Like, I think I hit it with the side of the arrow shaft somehow. Yeah. So it never
so
happened. But
our plan is, you know, we're going to wrap this season up probably in the next episode. Correct me here if I'm wrong, Kyler, but I think it's Area 6, Area 5, and Area 9 are the three.
And maybe 7. I think 7 maybe, too. 7 I also, know. I mean.
Maybe. I know that 6, 5, and 9 go until February the 15th. And if there's one we're leaving out, like 7, then we apologize. But nevertheless, the majority of the state is closed, and the majority of the surrounding states that our listening audience may travel and hunt on the weekends and whatnot, it's closed as we record. Season just ended yesterday. And, you know, it's that time of the year, so we're going to be wrapping up the podcast soon, and we're going to go over more of our silly stories, like Kyler's crazy goal to do that, as well as his also crazy goal of just randomly getting back into trad hunting when he said, you know, after he's already proven that was the most fun he never wanted to have again. He tried to have it again anyway. There's, you know, stuff like that. A full recap episode is coming as we wrap it up for the season. And kind of look forward to the off season. But before that, I mentioned, I ask you in a very short, brief way to kind of describe your season. But the other thing I was going to say is, you know, I guess this is kind of the time of the year to tell stories and kind of look back on some of the crazy things that transpired throughout the season. And we've got one for the ages for this podcast. We feel like, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to completely just throw this out there that I am not in agreement with what transpired that has brought us to this place where our good friend and longtime contributor and supporter of Louisiana Bowhunter, Michael Pepper, he's on the phone with us now, and he's going to be called on to tell a story for something that he did that I do not agree with. And if any of you follow and pay attention to our social media, I made a post of him with a deer that he killed recently, and I just simply said, Pepper shot a doe, and we're going to talk about it on a podcast. Our guests every week are brought to you by our friend Brian Chamberlain, the Chamberlain Lending Team with Movement Mortgage. And if you're in need of a residential loan, primary or secondary vacation investment, cash out, rate reduction, renovation for add-ons, any of these kind of needs, contact Brian. Nobody does better. Low credit scores, potentially 0% down, and the Movement Mortgage, 42% of their profits go towards charitable organizations through the Movement Foundation, and that sets them apart. Brian is licensed in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, NMLS number 114586, and Movement Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender, NMLS ID number 39179. So, Pepper, thank you for joining us on the podcast and, I guess, giving us something to talk about. How goes it?
I appreciate y'all having me.
So, first of all, before we dive off into you telling the story about the deer that's going to be kind of the main story that we tell on this podcast, tell us how your season went. I know you and your wife were back at it, chasing them, doing your thing. You guys got a routine, and we've talked about it on previous podcasts. I know y'all had some success. So, just kind of briefly, give us a rundown of how your season, how was your season this year?
It was extremely tough. Rachel had a pretty good season. She killed a 12-point, a 10-point, and an 8-point. They were all 5.5 to 6.5 years old. She ended up killing a doe. I ended up killing a doe. But it was, even for her, it was extremely, extremely tough, extremely challenging. moving around the properties, trying to move cameras and get on certain books. I ended up only hunting one buck and was hoping for the opportunity for two different does, this being one that we're going to talk about tonight. But I've also got another doe that I believe I'm 95% sure she's a doe, and she's got spikes that stay in velvet year round. And we've had her on camera as a mature doe for the last 5 or 6 years. So, but the season was extremely, extremely tough. A lot of people don't agree with me, but we saw a lot of chasing, for sure starting October 5th with some of our mature bucks, especially the one I was hunting. And from October 5th all the way to this past weekend, which is the closing weekend or the last weekend, they were still chasing does, and it threw a kink in everything. Everything was just so random. The bucks were so random because they were chasing the does and they were random, and it threw our whole season for a loop. But Rachel turned out pretty decent.
I'd say so. She killed 3 deer 5 years older that were with a bow and arrow. That's pretty good in most people's book. So I have a question for you that I'm going to rabbit hole, and I know Kyler's going to chime in at some point. We're going to get to the story that we're building this podcast around, and I'm kind of losing my voice, so I apologize if
I am too.
If there's gaps in here where I'm clearing my throat, but so you mentioned that you saw chasing October the 5th. Ish. Let's just say you've been watching deer off and on chase and do rut activities the entire season. So, which makes it really hard to hone in on certain strategies for hunting different patterns, because the pattern seems to change week to week to week to week, and it's all over the place. I have a theory, and I'm glad we didn't talk. None of this has been discussed, so this is out of left field, but because of the fact that I know your property well enough, and I don't know it that well, but I've been hunting with you, so I've seen it.
Right.
And I know the area, around what, I know basically what the topography looks like. And you hunt in a topography similar to a lot of the state, similar to East Feliciana Parish where I'm at. And the primary thing that you can say about it is it's very fragmented. There's a lot of timber management, and it's fragmented. There's private property over here that gets cut very conservatively, and then there's property over here that gets just whacked and is just nothing but pine thicket, and then, pasture land, and then, a trailer park, and then a neighborhood, and then a highway, and it's just, there's no consistency. And not only that, and also in the fragmentation, there's lots of different sizes of properties. And so between the timber and forest habitat management, then you also interject into that a wide, wide variety of diverse amounts of hunting styles and pressures and management strategies and lack of management at all strategies happening right next door to each other. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You got you and Rachel that are hunting with bows and arrows and only killing mature animals. And then over here, you got somebody that is pretty good. But I'm not saying about yours. I'm just hypothetically. All right. I'm painting a picture. You got some people. Obviously, I know you got some people over here that are running dogs and shooting everything. You got some people over here that they try to kill big bucks, mature bucks, but maybe they do. Maybe they don't. They rifle hunt as much as they bow hunt. And then you guys are bow hunting and managing it. So I want to know your opinion. You've been on this property for a long time. You've seen your neighbors change. You've seen the topography, or at least the habitat, you've seen that change. I have this running theory based off of a lot of conversations we've had on this podcast and a lot of experiences I've had as I've gotten, to know more people and my sphere of influence, as Kyler likes to talk about, the sphere of people that I'm networked with and I learn about and I know about and I have a relationship with enough to know, learning things, I'm starting to have this theory that this rut stuff that we're all contributing in it to how our weather, a lot, I say we are all, that was a very broad way to say it, but people are talking a lot about how the season should be pushed back. It's colder in February. We don't have the cold holiday season. Our ruts are all messed, like all that. But I'm wondering if I don't have, if I'm not onto something here with, when I go places that have large landowners that have habitat that's widely unchanged and a stable herd dynamic, the rut seems consistent. When I come into the South where there's 50 acres being hunted one way and then 500 acres being hunted another way and then 400 acres being hunted another way and then 5,000 acres of private over here being hunted one way and all of them are being habitat managed different, the rut is thrown into total chaos.
Yes.
And I think it's not just because, it's not just one of those factors. It's all of those factors. It's the management of animals, which changes the herd dynamic, the buck-to-doe ratio, the age structure, everything. It's the changing in habitat frequently, which changes the deer's patterns. Can you, I mean, am I crazy, or could you get on board with what I'm talking about based off your experience in a similar type place?
I completely agree. Now, I haven't deer hunted out Midwest or to be honest with you, the only place I've hunted outside of Webster Parish is Tensaw Parish over at Levi and M's.
Well, but think about this.
And
think about this. I don't mean to interrupt you. I want you to get right back to what you're going to say.
Go ahead.
But think about this. When you get over there, like around where the property you're talking about and all those properties up and down the river, they're along the river. They don't have thousands of acres of plantation pine forest that's being rotated every, you know, it's being thinned every 10, 15 years, then it's being wiped out and replanted every 20 years.
Right.
And you, not only that, but you don't have constant turnover of leases and hunting clubs, and you have a lot more large tracts of privately owned land. It's in a swamp. It's not pine forest. If you go to one of those pieces of property along the river, there may be some select cut in parts of it. There may be some agricultural changes, but generally speaking, it looks just like it did. It looks today in a large part the same way it did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And it's big chunks of property that don't turn over. So actually, go ahead with what you were going to say, but you're playing right into my point.
I was basically going to say, you know, due to our landscape, I hope I'm going to hit on the same point you're trying to hit on. I agree with what you're saying, because due to our landscape, our issues, me and Rachel we'll sit here at the house or try to eat lunch and try to figure out what we're going to do for the evening or talk about it that night, what I'm going to do the next morning. She don't really hunt mornings. And I'll try to put a plan together, but I'm not a plan hunter per se. I can't plan to go out to my property any day at all. You know, I got an idea of maybe where I'm going to go, but I may be walking to that stand and something kick in. I may hear dogs barking over here chasing deer, and that may reroute. There's a number of different things going through my head whenever I'm walking through. The wind may shift, or I may get down in a bottom and feel the wind circling in a corner due to the landscape, whatnot. Am I hitting on kind of the points that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, the point that I'm talking about is really just kind of, branching off of conversation directly at how where you're hunting the rut, you can't predict it. So you can't plan for it.
Yeah.
Because
that's right. That's right.
And that's because of like what you said. Well, not so much the wind. I mean, that happens to everybody, right? Whether you have pressure on your neighbors, whether you have large property or anything, the wind is what it is, you know. But yeah, I mean.
And I lost my kind of train of thought, kind of. What I was getting at is due to all that stuff, yes, I agree. Our rut, everything down here is so unpredictable, especially when the rut kicks in or there's any kind of chasing or anything at all, due to that.
Well, it's easy to say, it's easy for me to make that comment and say how predictable the rut is, and for, you know, for you to immediately say, or immediately to assume that I'm talking about, if you go to Kansas, the deer are going to rut in the first 2 weeks of November. And that's a very legitimate part of what I'm saying, because all of those factors play into that. But when you mention Tensaw Parish, and I'll mention there's a lot of Delta counties in Mississippi that are the same way. When you get on the west side of I-55, central and eastern Mississippi, and really Gulf Coast part of Mississippi, it's a lot different. The east side of I-55, and really the east side of Highway 61 for a lot of Mississippi, is agricultural, river bottom, high, large oak stand forest in the bluff country and river bottom hardwoods, and they don't change as much, and it's littered with huge landowners, big buy-in LLC equity shares type clubs, and old standing family properties that have been hunted consistently the same way, and they don't exist in a landscape where there's a ton of timber harvest and timber management going on. It's not rotation pine forest plantation, and it's not just the timber that's part of it, but when you get into that kind of property, what you also get into is a high turnover of human interaction on that landscape. That landscape's changing hands from a standpoint of hunting clubs and how many people are accessing that property. It's, you know, you've got when you get into the river bottom, it's highly valued hunting property, and there's large expanses of property that's been hunted by the same families, the same people, in much the same way for years and years and years. Their biggest influence is the Mississippi River. But if you go down there, and in my experience, I hunted that kind of stuff for the majority of my adult life, the rut is a way more predictable. When you get up in the hills, it, like you said, you might see a deer in full, just all out, just getting after it on Thanksgiving weekend, and then you might see one chasing a doe during the first weekend of turkey season in March. You know, I mean, it's all over the place. Anyway, that's not what we're on here to talk about, but I couldn't help but kind of play off of that, because it's been something that's like just really on my mind. Like, I'm dealing with it as well. I have 400 acres here in East Feliciana Parish. East Feliciana Parish has kind of a melting pot of genetics, and it's known for a place that you can go 10, 15 miles in one direction in the same parish and experience a totally different rut. It's been that way historically because of deer that were brought in and lots of reasons people coin. But it's just impossible. It's impossible to know what's going on.
Yeah. I would like to say one thing to your point. Me and Rachel discussed this, how part of that property, a major highway, cuts off 100 acres roughly of that property, and Rachel stays on that side of that highway hunting that 100 acres for the most part. She enjoys hunting over there. The deer are actually easier to hone in on and kill over there because just what you said, the landscape is similar. It's not but 100 acres, but 2,000 acres around me is pretty much exactly the same as that 100 acres that we hunt. And it is easier to hone in on the deer a little bit. And we discussed how hard the deer are to kill on the 400 and something acres across the road where I primarily hunt, where you came and hunted with me. The rut isn't necessarily harder to kill on, but we've leased that place for it's either 10 or 11 years. And I've killed a 5.5-year-old 145-inch 11 point off of it. And I killed a 3.5-year-old 130-inch 10 point off of it. And that's it. I mean, I killed rams off of it. And I killed about 3 does. But 10, 11 years of leasing that place, hunting it hard, we actually didn't hunt it for the first 4 years that we leased it, trying to build the population back up. We didn't hunt it at all. We just paid for it, hung cameras, put out some food, planted some food plots, and just kind of monitored the property for 4 to 5 years. And then we started hunting it. And And but I guess because of the landscape, like you're saying, that place is not impossible to hunt, but it's damn near impossible to kill a deer off of it.
It's
Mark, let me ask you this, to kind of cut through a lot of what you said. Are you kind of implying that the relatively vast changes in pressure and habitat in a short distance, like essentially like a deer, let's say a deer had a home range of, I'm just going to make something up, 2,000 acres, which would be huge, by the way, but let's pretend that it did. In Louisiana, that 2,000 acres could be made up of 10 hunting clubs, 200 acres each.
Right?
And each hunting club could have different pressure, different food, different ways of that it's being utilized. Like, some places might be totally abandoned. Some of it, you know, 10 people might hunt it every weekend. And so you're saying like the culmination of all those different that different stability or lack thereof, if you will, in a deer's environment could have some impact on rut action.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. So then, all right. I've got some pretty interesting stats that I think both of y'all would like.
So let me interject one more fact before you give us the facts, because I think that there's one more important thing to say. You hit the nail on the head in your analogy, but there's one other thing that I want to, that's kind of a symptom of the hypothesis problem that you presented. Okay. And I think the symptom is just as big of a potential problem as the issues. The symptom is that 2,000 acres, it might not be the actual home range of one single deer, but it is a snapshot of a herd of deer, right? Because they intermingle, whether they all use the hole or not, they do. So if six of those 10 200-acre clubs are managed for pressure and harvest in a good way, so that they're trying to take mature animals and have a good age structure and an appropriate buck-to-doe ratio and all that, and four of them are overhunted, or let's just say six of them are managing, three or four of those six are doing a really good job, two of them are kind of, but not really, and then you got four more. A couple of those hardly get hunted at all, so they become sanctuaries, and the other two are just raped. I mean, just hammered on from the opening day until the season closes, and maybe even beyond. The symptom of what ends up happening is the herd dynamic, the herd is all off. The age structure of that whole 2,000-acre snapshot, all of those factors, plus what it creates is this crazy, unnatural balance of age structure and buck-to-doe ratio, fawn-to-doe ratio, and all that. So I want to say that I think that the creation of that is as big of a problem as just the land and pressure. But go ahead with your fact.
Hey, if you're looking for a new piece of hunting property, or you have a piece of property you'd like to list for sale, contact our friend Slade Priest, the hunting land man. Slade's a Realtree United Country land pro, and he's more than just a real estate agent. Slade has spent his entire life in the outdoors, managing property, hunting, fishing, and he really prides himself on understanding putting the right buyer and the right seller together when it comes to outdoor recreational hunting property. And Slade was recently ranked number two in the country for 2020, Southern States Realty United Country Hunting Properties. So if you are in the market, no one sells more, Mississippi and Louisiana, and it's not too late to potentially get into a new piece of property even for this hunting season. Slade tells me you can get to closing pretty quickly, and he's got some fantastic properties recently listed and more coming all the time. So search the hashtag HuntingLandMan, and you'll find all kind of stuff. Slade's got a podcast where you can get all kind of information on land and the buying-selling process, so check him out and go find all of his listings at huntinglandmanms.com.
Okay, so I last week recorded with the Southern Outdoorsman guys, Jacob Myers, Andrew Maxwell, and they wanted to discuss hunting in the South, hunting swamps, and then like hunting in Louisiana versus other parts of the country. And I pulled up some statistics of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. And I found something that's pretty interesting to me that might correlate, or it might be like a third dimension to, I'm not going to come out and say like, you're trying to make a definitive point. I think that you're just throwing out some, hypotheticals as to, because Louisiana is different. It's got to be different for a reason, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And some of the things you're naming could be some of them. What's interesting, I'm going to give you a couple of statistics. Louisiana has 52,000 square miles of land. Alabama is 50,000 square miles of land, which is surprising to me that it's smaller. And then even more surprising is Mississippi is even smaller than Louisiana in square mileage at 48,500 square miles. So Mississippi's got 4,000 square miles more of land than Louisiana has 4,000 square miles of land more than Mississippi, 2,000 more than Alabama. But Louisiana is only covered 37% of the state in tree cover. It only has 37% of the state is actual forest. Everything else is either water, marsh, or ag, right? Mm-hmm. So 37%, which is really low. Comparatively, Mississippi, who is, like I said, 4,000 square miles smaller than Louisiana, is 67% forest cover. So two-thirds of Mississippi has a tree on it. One-third of Louisiana has a tree on it. And then the only state that's more than that is Alabama, is 70% tree cover. All right? So Louisiana, that has to be a factor. Just in the fact that, like, I know Louisiana and, like, we think, like, we're hunting trees and it's thick and, like, there's all this bedding and blah, blah, blah. But statistically, from, like, a tree habitat, forest habitat standpoint, we have literally half as much as Mississippi and less than half as much as Alabama does. And so in Mississippi, and I feel like Alabama also, have very predictable ruts. They're, you know, Mississippi's still pretty different from Louisiana. It has like this rut range, not as vastly different, not September to February like Louisiana has, you know. Mm-hmm. But still, like, you'll have a decent rut range, but their rut range is like more south to north variants. Ours is all over the place. Like, you could throw a dart at Louisiana, you get a different rut day. Yeah. You know. So I wanted to throw that out there because that was something that I hadn't considered. It's like, how much room in Louisiana does a whitetail have to live? Well, about 37% of Louisiana is where a deer could live. 67% in Mississippi is where a deer could live. 70% of Alabama is where a deer could live.
So
if we're only saying they live in the woods,
okay,
right?
So
most deer do.
Consider this then. And this is, again, just personal observation. I've hunted one of the most predictable ruts that I've ever hunted in the state of Louisiana is down in the area, I think it's Area 7, down in the marsh where there are no trees. The deer rut exactly the same, almost just like the Midwest. Now, they rut in October, but it's, you know, but that plays into some of my hypothesis. That area down there doesn't change. Other than tidal changes and maybe a storm, a year where there's more or less flooding based off of storm damage, those deer live in marshlands on the coast in basically marsh grass with the little, you know, little shrubby trees scattered here and there. Nobody timber manages that. Nobody clears that and builds houses. It's the same. It's been the same from forever. And they rut in the second and third week of October every single year. You come to East Louisiana Parish, and you have a rut that happens after Thanksgiving one year, and then three of your neighbors cut all their trees, and they p-
put in a new hunting club and they start shooting everything, and 2 years later, you've got rut happening three different times in one season on the property where the rut was the first week of December 2 years ago. That's the kind of stuff I'm keying off of.
Yeah, from the statistics that Kyler just gave, I realize we have the least amount of tree covered property in Louisiana, but could you conclude that the timber companies have more of an influence on the wildlife in Louisiana, turkey, deer, everything?
That's what
more
I'm getting.
Influence on the wildlife.
That's what I'm getting at. That's exactly what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, good or bad.
I'm not necessarily saying good or bad, but I'm just saying, this really wasn't the point of this podcast, but it's a good conversation.
a tangent's a tangent.
I'm not really tangent. I'm not really presenting a problem or a positive negative. I'm just like, it's as you know, all three of us on this podcast right now, all three of us are pretty hardcore about archery hunting for deer, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have our own this's and that's, but all three of us generally kind of live and breathe to chase deer with a bow and arrow. And
yep.
I think it's also very fair to say that figuring out the patterns of deer during the season, which a large part of that outside of the early season food pattern, the rest of it revolves around pre-rut, rut, and post-rut. And figuring out how the deer are using the landscape and how they're changing, and we're trying to hone in on changes in their behavior based off of the season and what's going on, and that tends to be extremely difficult certain years. And I'm just trying to kind of throw things against the wall to figure out what it might be, because those are great stats, great statistics that Kyler just shared, and it's interesting because, you know, that you put those kind of statistics and that kind of information in, and I look at it, and you compare it also against, like, I don't know these stats, but you compare it against, like, hunter participation numbers, harvest rates, the length of seasons compared to other places in the country, other states, and all that. You compare all these things, you put them all in a pot, and you mix them all up, and you try to come up with what does this all mean? What kind of effect does this have on our sport and on our passion? And the things that I can logically deduce based on my own experience are, when I go, and this is the same thing for turkeys too, by the way, exactly the same thing for, not necessarily there's no turkey rut, but I'm in terms of numbers of turkeys and where the turkey population is stable and not changing. When I go hunt large properties along the Mississippi River Basin where there's not as much fragmentation and there's not as much habitat change outside of the flooding, the ruts are much more consistent around New Year's and in January. They always have been my whole entire life. When I go out to the Midwest and places like that where, the other than the rotation of ag, the places I've been going for 15 years look the exact same every November. Exactly the same. Nobody's harvesting trees. The hunting pressure changes a little bit, but the state laws limit the harvest to the point that it's not having a drastic effect and change. So if you don't have a disease kill off, the herd dynamic and the age structure tends to be more stable, and everything is pretty much the same within a week or two. Then I go down to South Louisiana, where the marshlands don't change a whole lot outside of tidal effects from the water, and it's one of the places in Louisiana where things stay the same. But then I go to your property, Pepper, where the neighbors are doing different crap, and the people that own property around you and on you are changing by cutting and timber managing all the time. I go into East Feliciana Parish. I go into East Mississippi, where these things are all the same, and you might go a year or two where the rut's kind of the same. It happens around the same time, and then all of a sudden you have a year, like you just said, where they're chasing does on and off all year long, and you can't figure out what the heck's going on.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I just kind of ponder those things. It's not really a negative or a positive. I'm not trying to, like, present, like, anything controversial. I'm just trying to talk about it, you know?
Yep.
Figure it out, so to speak. But I got a segue, okay? I got a segue.
Okay.
So we're talking about all of these things, and one of the main points that I'm trying to make in this is with the habitat change and the fragmentation, what you get is you get a unstable or inconsistent deer herd in terms of age structure and all and buck to doe ratio. So, you know, you don't get the at least what you get from science, what your buck to doe ratio should be, what your age structure should be for all of that. So what you don't end up seeing is a ton of really, really old deer frequently. The story that we're about to tell is about the oldest deer that I know of that somebody can actually document and prove. And why I don't agree with you shooting the deer is because I thought that once a deer gets to that age, that you should just give her a pass. But you didn't. So go ahead and tell us the story. We want to give this deer as much. We want to make her famous because she earned it, even though you shot and killed her.
I'm probably not the best to tell this story, but I'm going to do my best. I was pretty emotional whenever I called my wife that I had killed the deer. I'm going to try to start from the beginning and hopefully I don't skip too much, but we started leasing that property in, I'm pretty sure it's 2012. We started getting pictures of that deer. Me and Rachel kind of argued last night or night before last when we were trying to dig up some more pictures of her about how she showed up on the property. And as I remember it, she was on the property with two fawns. And at some point in time during that season, she ended up getting shot, hit by a car. Her face was deformed. The bridge of her nose was crooked, roughly halfway. It was just curved to the right, to her right. Her tongue hung out and her bottom lip sagged. It was pretty sad looking, and we were going to try to kill her because we didn't think she'd have a good quality of life. And boy, were we mistaken. When we first started leasing that property, we had a resident doe, which was her with two fawns, and a resident buck that was a set 2.5-year-old 7-point. And that's all we could prove at the time were resident deer. There were more deer that moved through the property from time to time, but we got pictures of those deer all the time. I had tried to kill that deer about 6 or 7 years ago. I had started hunting grams about 6 or 7 years ago. I had shot at her one time when I first started hunting her. She didn't move in the daylight very well. Even then, she was on up in age, and I thought, man, that'd be a good mature doe to take.
So at this time, she's 6 or 7 years old, 6 or 7 years ago.
Yes, yes. And due to the dates, me and Rachel know for a fact that she was 13 and a half years old. I believe she was 14 and a half years old, but we know for a fact. Well, when we first started leasing the place, I thought she was 3.5 years old. She was a good sized deer. She was mature, had two babies. So
she was at least two.
So she's at least 2.5 because she's got two babies. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying not to bounce around the age of this deer and cause any confusion with anybody listening to this because I've derived it. I think she's 14 and a half years old. I'm not going to send the jawbone off or anything like that to get it cut and aged or anything. It's kind of blunt, but I don't have anything to prove to anybody. I'll get the pictures together, probably post them on Facebook, but I'm having this deer shoulder mounted and I'm having her skull Euro mounted with her jawbone. I'm on DMAP. I'm not giving DMAP the jawbone. I'm going to discuss it with them, go show them the jawbone, but I'm not leaving the jawbone with them. Anyways, back to my story. So I had tried to hunt this deer as mature doe 6 or 7 years ago. I shot at her one time and missed her. It pushed her even more into nighttime movement. We did get some daytime pictures of her, but it was, you know, I'd go in there and hunt her and she wouldn't come in. And she could have smelled me. There's so many variables that could have been the reason she didn't come in. She was super smart. I had a good idea where she was bedding. I never went into her bed. I didn't push to kill her that hard. I know I'm skipping stuff in this story, and I really don't want to, but I don't know if I need to jump on this year or not,
set this stage for you. I'll try to keep it that way. You can hit the points that come to your mind. So we're establishing here that you began leasing the property in 2012, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you first started taking pictures of her, and she was at least 2 years old in 2012.
Minimum.
Maybe 3. Old. At least 12, yes. Maybe 3. So so when you leased the property, you started taking pictures of her in the summer of 2012? Or preseason, early season, 2012?
It was in preseason of 2012.
So if she was 2 years old, then this coming summer, she would be 14, right? No. 12. No, yeah, she would be 14. If she was 3, then she would have be turning 15 this summer. Is that right? We agree?
2012, this 2022.
Yeah. This is 2022, so her birthday would have been sometime late spring, early summer.
She'd be 12 and a half this summer, if that were the case.
Okay. All right. So she was 2, she'd be 12 and a half. If she was 3, she'd be turning 13 and a half. Okay. So there's your timeline. And you're saying that around about 2016, you started hunting her, and you thought she was 6 or 7 years old at that time, or five or six years old at that time.
I don't remember the dates the other night, but we actually had a fair amount of daytime pictures of her in 2015 or 2016, and that was one of my, you know, that just told me I can go in there and kill that deer.
And you know,
or at least I thought in my mind.
and you know, and I know this because I saw the deer with my own two eyes in the daylight when I was hunting with you. So, but
filmed it, yes,
yeah,
filmed
I filmed
it,
her, but and that was 2 years ago in 2020. Mm-hmm. But, but to paint the picture even more for people that may have missed it, you know, this because during that first year, she got an injury to her face and her tongue hangs out. And if you go look on our Instagram, the picture, your picture of the deer after you shot her tongue hangs out and she can't put it back in her mouth. So there's no mistaking this deer. So that's how. For anybody questioning that, that's how you know that you're taking pictures of the same deer year after year, because she's got 4 or 5 inches of tongue hanging out one side of her mouth.
Right, right. Okay. And me and Harmon, I took her to Harmon yesterday, and we discussed, and they might have, it's not that they didn't believe me, but they were kind of in disbelief that they asked me if she had any use of her tongue, and I said, no, she did not have any use of her tongue. We finally got videos of her, trail cam videos over this year, and we kind of wondered how she ate acorns. We saw in pictures how she ate corn, and she would lean her head to the side and put the side of her mouth down on the ground. It was unique I guess is the best way to put that. But she would put the side of her head down on the ground to eat corn or rice bran. And we wondered how she ate acorns. And we finally got videos over this year picking up the swamp chestnut acorns or the cow oak acorns, whatever you want to call them. I call them cow oak acorns. And she would pick them up. She would pick them up and she would look, turn her head to the right and look straight up at the sky and work the acorn back to the back of her throat to where she could chew it up with her premolars. And
like a water bird, cow bird.
Yeah, yeah.
Would swallow a frog or something.
That's right. That's right. And they kept asking me they asked me several times, you know, did she have any use for lip? Did she have any use for tongue? And I was, you know, the whole time that she's eating on the videos that we finally got, her tongue is sitting there flopping around. She could not draw her tongue in at all. And you want to say it's sad and at first, but I mean, this deer, I believe, was minimum 13 and a half years old. I mean, that intrigued me, you know, it, and I know that you kind of didn't agree with me, with the way everything played out, but, we had this discussion too, that how much this deer meant to me. She was just a true trophy. I had been hunting this deer for six or seven years off and on, and had one opportunity to shoot at her. It was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I guess. I finally got this deer to come out in the daytime. She was out there for probably 30 minutes. And I'm talking about she was mean. She didn't like anybody else eating around the corn with her or anything like that, or even acorns. She would run all the does, you know, within a 5 or 10 yard radius around her. She just would turn and run them off, kick at them. And the first time I shot at her, it was getting dark. It was right at last light. Or I was losing light pretty quick, and I was fixing to have to make something happen. She finally turned. She wouldn't turn broadside for 30 minutes. She finally turned, and she ran a deer off, a doe that was trying to come up behind her. And then she turned around, and she came back to the corn. She was there with her baby. And I finally had somewhat of a broadside shot. She was quartered to me just ever so slightly, and I drew back, and I shot. Well, I got down and walked over, couldn't find any blood. I saw the way she ran out, so I walked over there to a trail she ran out on. I found some blood. Well, she opened up pretty good. I mean, bleeding really good. And probably 50 yards from where I shot her, I found my arrow. My arrow was covered in blood from tip to tail. So I picked my arrow up, I put it in my quiver, and I just left. I knew she was quartering to me. I didn't really know what call to make. I thought it might be one lung and liver, but it was going to be deadly. I went home. I told Rachel about it. I was shaking like a leaf. And I told her I was going to go back hunting in the morning at that spot. I was going to get down about 8:15, 8:30 and go look for her. It was going to be cool that night, so sitting there wasn't, I mean, with her laying out there in the woods, it wasn't going to be a problem with her, whether the meat was good or not. Anyways, I went back out that morning. I got up in the stand, and it was just barely breaking daylight. I mean, to the tune that, you know how it is when you're sitting there in the stand in the morning, and the woods are hazy, and even if you see a buck, you might get a glimpse of horns, but you don't really know. You think it was a buck. The body looked like a buck, and you think you saw horns. Well, it was hazy like that. The sun wasn't up yet. It wasn't good daylight. She walked up to the other side of the corn pile, and I grabbed my bow, And I thought, no way. Well, I could see either her tongue dangling or a leaf on the side of a deer's mouth dangling. But I was 99% sure it was her. And I told Rachel to check the pictures. Well, I got down, and I went, and I walked almost a mile. I tracked blood for about, I think it was a little over half a mile, close to, it was between half a mile and three quarters of a mile. I tracked it on my Onyx, and I lost blood. It quit. Well, I knew about where she used to bed, so I made me a loop around, nothing. I found nothing. I followed tracks. I stayed out there for 4 hours looking, and I couldn't find anything. Well, I came back home, and I told Rachel. So, okay, well, I'm pretty sure I saw her this morning alive, so let's look at the pictures tonight and see if she's alive, to see if she shows up. Well, the next day, we went out and checked the cameras, and sure enough, she showed up that night. She was alive. Okay. Well, what that in turn, I went a month before, 3 to 4 weeks before I killed her, actually killed her. And I'm thinking this whole time, if I do kill her, I really need to take my time cleaning her to see where I hit her, because it was just dark enough I couldn't see my arrow. So I couldn't see my arrow impact. Well, when I finally did kill her, I took my time cleaning her, caping her out, skinning her. There was so much damage from that broadhead that I really couldn't tell anything other than the fact that, so I started looking at the skin as I skinned it down. I didn't just do like a normal doe, split her all the way down the front, cut her tail off, and then pull the hide all the way down to her front shoulders or her neck. I was real meticulous on how I did it. I couldn't find any holes in her. So I don't know actually if I hit her. Hold on just a second. I'm getting a phone call. I'm not going to answer it. I'm trying to decline it. If I lose you, I'll call you right back. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Are y'all still with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. Anyways, I skinned her down. I couldn't find any holes in her hide where I had hit her previously, in the shoulder area, in the liver area. I thought I hit her lung and liver. I couldn't find any holes there. So I actually think that I don't know what happened. So I'm only speculating here. I think due to the chain of events, I may have shot another deer, and in turn it caused me to lose a deer because I thought she was the one that walked back up when she ran the other deer off. So I may in turn have not shot her and wounded her like I thought, but I did lose a deer over that, is what I feel like I did. I think that deer that I shot at the time that I thought I shot Grimms the first time, I thought it was her. There was enough blood on the ground that I do think it died. But I wanted you to know that, Law, that I don't think that I wounded her 3 to 4 weeks ago. I want to, there is something else I want to say, about this. I know I'm talking in circles, but, when I cleaned this deer, okay, she was, I think she was at least 13 and a half. All right. No doubt we got pictures, I guess, that she was 12 and a half. So I'm just going to work off that for right now. So she's 12 and a half years old. She didn't have any babies last year or the 2 or 3 years prior to that. So I assume she was a barren doe. Well, this year she showed up and she had a baby with her, a fawn. And when I cleaned her Sunday, I dug through the gut file because I had to know. I found the sacs the embryo sacs, and I cut them open. And 12 and a half years old, she had two embryos in her. She had been bred within the last 2 to 3 weeks. And I'm not a biologist, so I can't tell you the day or anything like that. But I have looked at it enough. I do know that it was within the last 2 to 3 weeks. They were about a half an inch to three quarters of an inch long. So she was still contributing to the herd, not just taking food from the herd, if you will, like we would shoot an old or barren doe, for that reason. But she was still contributing to the herd. I know what I was going to say earlier. Me and my wife had talked about this over the years several times, brought it up several times. Excuse me. We believe that she single-handedly, and it sounds ludicrous, we believe that she single-handedly repopulated our property for us down there. So when I tell you there's an emotional attachment to this deer, not only do I think she's a trophy because of her age, because of the history that we can prove how old she is, we think that she gave us the opportunity to manage a property and build a property up through helping us repopulate the property.
So you killed her for it.
Right. Well,
I'm just giving you a hard time, man. So, all right.
Keep it above the belt, if you will.
All right, so let me be. I've been giving you a hard time about this ever since you. Do what?
I said, and it's okay.
I'm good for that. I've been giving you a hard time ever since you thought you shot her the first time. So, and I had a feeling all along, even through you actually killing her a couple of days ago, that we were going to eventually have this conversation, and I was going to keep on giving you a hard time about it without any real explanation, just being a good friend that I am and holding you accountable and giving you a hard time. But I want to be clear about it, okay? Like, I don't have any kind of real, like, issue about it. My only point is, me as a person, just the person that I am, when I hear your story and I try to put myself in your shoes, I don't know if I would have had the heart to kill her. Like it just, and I know me and my wife were actually, because I've been kind of keeping her up to date on your story, because it's a crazy story to have a deer that old that you can document, whether she's 12 or 13 or 14, doesn't matter, any of those ages, you know, for you to have such a documented story and timeline with a deer and to be able to have not just a timeline, but so many different encounters. I mean, I'll give one example. You could have killed her the day that I was filming you. You didn't, because we were hunting that bigger buck in the area and we weren't there to shoot her. But that's just,
I hadn't thought of that, but you're exactly right.
Yeah, you could have killed her. She was 20-something yards broadside. I mean, in the daylight. We didn't think anything about it. You looked at me and goes, that's that old doe that I've been taking pictures of forever, you know?
Yeah.
And that season, another thing that, like, this is what I'm getting at. We both got really excited because you're like, that big deer's always with her. Remember? He was always with her.
Yeah.
And so here she comes, here she comes, and then here he comes. So you have not just like this trail camera library of deer, of pictures of a deer that you can prove how old she is. You've got all kinds of storylines. You have this really nice buck that you hunted that, I mean, you didn't end up killing that deer, but you had a story behind chasing that deer and him being tied directly to her. Probably she's probably his mother, you know, and you and I actually getting a chance to film that deer and film her bring him in the daylight, the way she had been doing, all these other things that you and Rachel experienced with this deer. The fact that she was the only, or at least it seemed like the only local doe on the property, and the fact that she, whether she did completely or not,
she obviously played a huge role in your management strategy and repopulating this area and getting the deer herd back up and healthy. She obviously played a huge role in that, regardless of how much emphasis you want to put on it. She had some large role in it. It's just a crazy story. So I've been keeping my wife updated about it too, and you know, because it's just such a cool story. And so I just want to say, like, I've been giving you a hard time, but I understand it. I get it. I completely understand how much of a trophy and how important it is to you. I know for me, like, I don't know that I could have done it, but at the same time, I told my wife the other night, because she kind of, you know, she kind of was like, oh, I can't believe he shot it. And I'm like, well, but you know, here's the thing. Here's the truth of it. In the wild, deer don't die a peaceful death just because they get old. Usually when
That's
they get old,
exactly right.
They get eaten alive because they're too weak to run away from danger. You know, they starve to death, and typically they get eaten alive is what typically happens. It's because even if they're starving to death, they get too weak to defend themselves or to run away from danger, and they end up getting caught and eaten by a predator in their old age. So you actually did her a huge favor, and I know that, but just the sentimentality of the whole thing and the history, I get it. But I've been giving you a hard time because I can't put myself in your boots, so to speak. Like,
well,
I just
Rachel,
don't know
Rachel
if I could have shot
the
her.
Same thing. Rachel said the same thing. She didn't know if she could have shot her or not. And we talked about it. I mean, most people don't talk about whether they can shoot a deer or not. And we actually talked about it. I felt like I could shoot her and wouldn't have a problem with it. Even though you call me ruthless, it's because of all this other stuff and gave me hell about it. But she didn't know if she could actually shoot the deer, if she saw the deer or not. Mm-hmm. And you know, I told her, I don't know if I can or not, neither. But I did. But, you know, whenever I called Rachel and told her, I wasn't going to say this, but I'm not an emotional person at all whatsoever about anything. So when I found this deer, she poured blood. I made a horrible shot on the deer. My bottom limb hit either the tree or the stand. I don't know which. Going back into the spring and the early summer, I bought some different arrows to try to lighten my setup. I really wanted to try to get my brace height back down into the factory settings or the factory suggested brace heights. And I did. So my bow's a little faster, but it's a little bit louder too. So I hit my bottom limb hit something. My bow's louder. When I leaned out around the little tree that I was in to shoot, her baby looked straight up at me. I was busted. I was committing. I had already committed. So I came on out around the tree, and I drew, and I shot. When I shot, I hit her in her back helm. I felt the bottom limb hit something, and I watched the arrow turn out of my bow to the left. She was facing right. She was quartered to me just a touch, but mostly broadside. It was the first broadside opportunity I got. And when the arrow left my bow, I had a knock right exit from my rest. Well, as it left, I saw it turn just a touch, and it was going to liver. And at the moment of a shot with a traditional bow, for me, I'm trying to watch so many things, like the arrow and the deer. I'm trying to watch her baby, trying to watch where she goes whenever she runs off after she's hit. So I'm thinking at the time I hit liver. I'm okay with that, but I text Rachel, I text Harmon, I think I text y'all too. I don't remember if I did or not, but I text a few different people that I had just shot grams, and it was a bad hit, and I was going to give her some time. So I gave her about an hour and a half or so. Rachel had killed a deer the evening before. that was hanging here in the tree that I left hanging all night. It was going to be cool, and I prefer to let them hang if I can for a day or two before I quarter them up, take them to the processor. Well, she was hanging, and it was going to heat up to in the 50s that day. And so I gave her time. I got down. I went to look for it's heating up. I called my father-in-law and asked him to go make sure there's not any flies on the one at the house. I find the deer. She poured blood. I hit the artery in the rump is where I hit her. I hit her in the hip. And the amazing thing about the shot was actually where I hit her. I told you I saw the arrow headed towards liver, front of gut area. So I expected a bad shot anyways. When I cleaned her, I had hit her in her hip. Keep in mind, she was quartered to me ever so slightly, mostly broadside. I hit her in her hip. I severed the artery, and my broadhead broke off in her. I found my broadhead, hit her in the right hip, found my broadhead at the back of the left lung. Did not penetrate the diaphragm just yet. It was in the guts, but right behind the left lung. It was great penetration, horrible hit, but I could not explain so many things that happened there. She was quartered to me ever so slightly. How did my arrow go in her rump and end up at the back of her left lung?
Did she wheel back around to the left?
Well, she turned to run straight away from me. So my theory is, I've watched videos of some deer loading up and turning and running away. And when they load up, I had to have some answers, man. So on YouTube, I watched some videos. And so when they load up, when some of them load up to turn a 90-degree turn to run straight away from you, from, say, broadside, they bring their back feet up towards their front feet, and then they plant and turn to run 90 degrees away from you, back where she, and that's what she did, back where she came from. And I feel like, due to all the noise, my limb hitting, my bow's a little bit noisier. Her baby knew that she was looking at me as I leaned out from around the tree and drew. I don't know if she took off running before I even released and scared, you know, Grams. I really don't know what all happened, but the video showed that they bring their hind feet up towards her front feet, load and turn. And I think what happened was she brought her rump up forward just a touch. And as she planted, her rump dropped some, which put it, you know, just right in front of my arrow. But it was a crazy, crazy, it was a lot of crazy things that went on whenever I skinned her and finally, you know, I found my arrow. I thought it was through her hip, just straight through her hip, because she was mostly broadside. So I thought it was straight through her hip. I severed the artery, good deal. And then when I cleaned her, I found, like I say, I found the broadhead up behind her left lung. It kind of threw me for a loop. But
Kyler, what's your take on all this? What would you have done?
Well, it's interesting because, like, I can kind of commiserate with you know, the struggle of traditional hunting. It's not easy, and you're not always in control. Like, you don't have that much of control on the outcome of, like, shot placement. The deer can move a lot by the time the arrow gets there. I mean, I'm hearing all this for the first time. It's interesting. I feel like I was there, you know, because, like, I'm shooting trad this year too. But I don't really have a whole lot to say about it, man. It's just that I'm just glad to get the story out there more than anything.
Well,
you know,
I know that you.
I appreciate you saying you feel like you was there. I am not a good storyteller. I know that, And I feel like that I'm not telling the story to give her enough credit for her age and all she's lived through on our lease. But I tried, and I appreciate you saying that.
I think the picture's painted very clearly. I'm curious from you, Kyler. I know that, you know, it's well documented, so to speak, on this podcast that your only real method of hunting is public land access style of hunting. And so I know that you don't have the kind of experiences in your hunting career where, you know, you would be following a deer like this. But if you try to put yourself in that shoes, do you have any thought about whether or not you actually shoot this deer or whether you let this deer go and just kind of let her earn, she's earned her keep?
I'd probably end up shooting her. I mean, regardless, I mean, obviously I wouldn't know how old she was on public land. I'd shoot her. It kind of reminds me a little bit of when we talked to Dave Moreland, when he said everybody tries to manage deer so much that half your deer die of old age. She's not immortal, right? Yeah. Like she can't live forever. It's not like she's a vampire, and if you don't drive a stake through her heart, she'll just live for all of eternity. You know, I mean, she could die next year. She could die this summer. She's already beyond the normal lifespan of what we think a deer lives to be. So I don't necessarily think that shooting her is that bad. I don't disagree with that at all.
Well, I don't know what it is about. Like, I get it. You know, I get it. Like, I can't explain what it is that gives me that feeling of, like, I hear your story and I put myself in there and I think about this emotional attachment to this animal, because I understand what it is to manage private property and to know, obviously I've never had an experience with a deer for that long, you know, with that much history and all that. But I do understand what it's like to follow a deer around for season after season after season and feel almost like you have this is going to sound really strange, but, and I know people that are listening that have been managing and hunting, or maybe not even like heavily managing, but just hunting the same property private for a long time. There's deer that you see year after year after year, and you never get the chance to kill them. And you almost start to get like this relationship with the deer. You start to, you know, being able to, more so than just the kind of patterns that you identify when you're trying to make a strategy for hunting, even more so than that, you start to pick up on things about these deer. You take enough pictures of them and you see them in passing on your property enough that you start to feel like you know them, you know,
100% right. Yeah.
And it's that weird, like, it's what makes us human, you know, emotion and cognitive thought is what makes us human. That deer doesn't have those things, but we do. And I guess it's something about that. When I hear your story and I put myself in those shoes and I'm like, those human emotions that you have when you start to feel that way about an animal that you've just become so tied to in different ways.
It's hard to describe to people. So I'm going to give it a stab. This shooting this deer is not about me. It's all about Grams, her age, her lifespan, and what went on in her story. But I want to say something about me and Rachel as far as how we hunt. We're not an average hunter, especially in our area. Let me point that out. In our area, we're not an average hunter. We say that we study deer. I'm not a biologist. She's not a biologist. I don't go out there and pull blood samples and all that kind of stuff from them, you know. But to say that we love these deer, I don't know if people understand that. And we love our research, our style of research, poor man's research, trail cameras, sightings on the stand. We soak up so much information from those deer on everyone that we don't shoot. And everyone that lives, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And so what I was trying to get out, we love these deer. And I don't know how to explain all that, but we don't have any kids. We have a dog. I love my dog. We love these deer. This is what we do in our off season. You know, we've got trail cameras out, and we're looking at deer movement during the off season throughout the summer. I really don't have anything else to add to that, but other than we love what we're doing. We love what we do. That's why we hunt private land. We can't do this on public land. I mean, you can to a certain extent, I guess, but not to the extent that we go, as far as putting food out and having those same deer come to the exact same spot, year in and year out, week in and week out.
No, you can do that on you can do that on public land for a little while.
Until you get caught.
Yeah, technically. Some people do. Yeah. Some people do.
Well, they have different goals in mind than you do, though.
Hey, Michael, let me ask you this. When did y'all start calling her Grams?
This year.
Y'all start calling her Grams this year? Now, okay.
I just named her this year. I did not know what to name her. Well, we've talked about it in the past, how we name all of our deer. We got that much of a relationship with them, but we never named her. I finally named her this year. I think she earned an elderly name, I guess, but we finally named her this year.
So, like, as we start to wrap up, because the story is, you know, I'm glad we were able to give a lot of time to get the story out of it. You feel like you don't tell a good story, but you do tell a good story. You told it in detail, and that's, you know, something like this is, we're not going to have this story year after year. It's just not going to happen. Well, I just don't believe
it. Thank y'all for giving me the opportunity to tell her
story. Yeah, man. Well,
I really think she deserves it.
It's a great story. And like I said, I don't anticipate a lot of people having, if we look at it for what it is, it's, unless there's somebody out there that's prepping it right now, it's going to take you a long time to develop a 12-year relationship with a deer and then kill it. So, at least 12 years. So, you know, but I want to ask you, because I have one personal, I guess, story or bit of information that I can parallel with this. I have a deer I have a small 50-acre piece of property that my parents own in Mississippi, and we don't hunt it that much. My dad hunts it primarily. It's his place, and me and my son go there and hunt a time or two every year. We don't kill many deer off of it, but it's in a good place. It's surrounded by all larger pieces of property, and it's, you know, pretty hardwoods and all that. But we have a deer on that property right now. It's probably this year. I'm going to guess it's 140 inches.
Mm.
It was probably in its prime. It was probably more in the 150s. It's a 10 point.
What?
I'm going to guess he might be 9 years old. I know for sure the first time I ever took his picture, he was pushing 140 inches, and it was in November or December of 2018. So he was probably 4 years old in 2018. Mm-hmm. So he's, what, eight now? Seven, eight, or nine, depending on how old he was. I don't think he's nine. I think he's probably eight, maybe.
At least eight.
Turning eight, you know, would be turning eight this spring. We haven't been able to kill him. We've had plenty of daylight pictures of him the last couple of years. We haven't been able to kill him. And I don't know that we will, because he doesn't look very healthy anymore. He's got a lot of horns.
You never know.
Well, the season's over, for one.
But next year.
Maybe. So, but I'm going to ask you, like, he's made a dramatic change. Just last year he was very impressive. He was big, he was fat, he was healthy, and he was the boss. There were a couple of other mature bucks, 4 and 5 year old bucks that were mature bucks, and he seemed to be. We had pictures of him sparring with them, running them off, etc. We've never seen him from the stand on 50 acres, okay? But we have hundreds of pictures of him, and we've got pictures of him this year. And the one notable thing, and the neighbor has pictures of him doing this too. I don't know if you've ever seen this. The deer will lay down around a food plot or around a feed area. He will literally sleep with his nose on the ground.
We see that.
Do you see that?
A lot. Yes, we see that a lot.
This deer,
where they get, yeah.
He's made a hat. Like he's. I don't know if he's sick or if he's just old, but you can kind of see his hip bones. He doesn't have that strong, healthy, mature buck look. He looks like an old man. And he's wary enough that nobody can see him. Between us and the neighbors, nobody has ever really seen nobody's ever seen him from a tree stand. But we got tons of pictures of him, us and the neighbor. And now he sleeps in the middle of the food plots. He sleeps right in front of our stand, in front of our cameras where we put corn on the ground. And when other bucks show up, he just leaves. We have gotten no pictures of him following a doe or sparring with any other bucks like we have in the past. And I feel,
deer?
Huh?
Go ahead.
I just feel like he's just changed. You know, he's.
Do you remember what time of the year in 2018 you got him? And the reason I ask is, do y'all remember me talking about a deer that we named B.B. King?
Not really.
It was a while back. Anyways, he was 9.5 or 10.5. He showed up in 2014, and I think he was 5.5 at the time. If you saw him, he was a minimum of 5.5. He could have been 6.5. I don't know, but he grew so much in the next few years that we finally quit getting pictures of him. I think he might have died of old age. I'm not sure. But at 7.5, he was his largest. At 8.5, what I think he was 8.5, he was big. He wasn't quite as big as 7.5, but it seemed like he peaked at 7.5. But at 9.5-ish, either 9.5 or 10.5, whatever he was, he dropped off considerably, like you're talking about. But he did not slow down during the rut.
Yeah.
He rutted himself down so bad that he looked poor that year. He lost his horns January 1st of that year, and I never saw him again.
Well, this deer, his horns, as far as mass and width, and even main beam length, haven't changed much, but his tine length has shortened, which is, you know, kind of typical. And it's mostly his body and the way he's acting. And I'm not going to say he didn't participate in the rut at some point. Back when we first started taking pictures of him, the first time we ever took a picture of him was kind of that period in time. I think it was in December, right before Christmas, when we had several new deer show up because the rut was really getting going. We were getting deer cruising during the daylight, and all of a sudden this, like, really nice-looking mature but young mature 10-point shows up. You know, real picket fence, symmetrical kind of deer, and we're like, wow, we've never seen him before. And he's already at least probably 4 years old. You know, if not, he's a giant 3-year-old, but I'm fairly confident he was 4. And we took his picture for a while, and then he disappeared, and we didn't take his picture the next year. And then he showed back up, and the last couple of years he's been around a lot. And this year he just acts different. I just wonder – he's kind of one of those historical deer. I don't know whether to expect to see him next year. I honestly felt like he was maybe sick. I never could tell that he was wounded, but he just didn't act right. And like I said, it's just, I've never had a deer, especially a deer with that kind of age and big mature deer that would just literally, mean, he would sleep like we would. I mean, like, we got pictures of him, I mean, just sleeping for 30, 45 minutes right in the wide yeah. open, you know.
Maybe and, he'll come back next year, but I think you know as well as I do that if he does come back, you could probably expect him, if he's a probably 140-inch 10-point right now, you might even could expect him to be 120 to 130-inch 8-point or yeah. something.
Well,
next
if his
year,
health is declining,
point.
If his health is yeah. declining, he's not going to grow the horns. But anyway, yeah, I didn't want to dive too far off into that. We've, you know, we need to start wrapping up. But it's an awesome story. Congratulations on the success of your efforts. I can't put myself in your shoes so much, but I'm glad you're able to see all your hard work come. And I'm glad that you can kind of put the whole thing to rest in terms of, you know, what happened. Whether you shot her or not, you know, you didn't wound her, you know that there's a finality to it, and that's cool. And I'm glad yeah. we could give her her due respect. Like, that's, I think a lot of people that listen to this are probably think that we're a little bit crazy for dedicating a podcast to giving the respect that we perceive is owed to just an old doe. But
well,
they're the hardest animal in the woods to hunt, so we might as well.
Nothing against. I'm not trying to say that anything against how Kyler believes with shoulder mounts. I want to say what I believe with shoulder mounts. So I don't want anybody to misinterpret what I'm trying to say against Kyler. The way we feel with our shoulder mounts is the ultimate respect for the mature deer that we intend on killing at a certain age. We think that is the ultimate respect that we can give those animals with a picture, a story, and a shoulder mount of those deer, not to showcase them for our benefit, you know, to truly have those deer showcased for what they were in the wild.
Yeah,
but
I think a lot of people
can
get on board
with
that.
I think I said it earlier, but I'm getting Graham shoulder mounted. I stumped Carmen when I took her in there and showed him what I want done. I just wanted her to look the same exact way that she does right now. And I wanted to get her skull bowled out and euroed with her jawbone so I could showcase that and take it apart and show the jawbone wherever I wanted to. But
well, it's very cool. It's a great story to end the kind of wind up the season on a, you know, something unique, something unique and really cool story to tell. So,
well, I appreciate it.
Well, starting to wrap up here. Kyler, you got anything else before we close it out?
No, I'm good, man.
Hope everybody had a good season. And I know, you know, one thing that kind of came to mind that I think we should mention is this is the time of the year where everybody is packing up and breaking down and all that kind of stuff. If you're doing that, be safe. Climbing up in trees, moving tree stands, getting stands down out of trees and doing that kind of work. You know, be safe in those ventures. And you know, don't put your bow up and forget about it. We're gonna wrap the season up for the podcast next week with the final episode. Kind of recap more, do more season recap kind of conversation. And start looking ahead to the off season and all that kind of thing. But in the meantime, if you're out and about, be safe in the woods. And for those of you that still have a couple of weeks left, good luck. Enjoy the cold weather. You're about to get some really, really cold weather if that's your thing. And check us out at LouisianaBowhunter.com. Follow us. Join our community group on Facebook and all those things. Pepper, thank you so much for joining us and telling your story. And for
thank y'all very much
for being a positive contributor to the Louisiana Bowhunter community as well. We greatly appreciate it, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. If you have anybody you'd like to hear on the show, reach out to us at info@LouisianaBowhunter.com. And if you want to help support Louisiana Bowhunter, go by your local archery shop and pick up some merchandise. If you don't have any at your local shop, let us know and we'll reach out to them. Or pick up your gear at LouisianaBowhunter.com and we'll ship it out to you same day. See you next week.